Hi, this is Chip Heath, and this is the podcast on advanced customer experience, taking up some topics that we didn't have a chance to talk about in the Power of Moments. It does assume that you've read, at least skimmed, the basic framework in the book, and you're familiar with that. And so we'll take off and talk about some things that we didn't get a chance to talk about in the book. I think the first thing that I want to highlight is that this is a book about moments. And as such, it differs from one of the most fundamental tools of existing customer experience work, and that is the journey map. Very often when we're talking about a customer's experience with a service or a product, we'll define the film strip of every encounter that they make with the product on the way to using that product or service. And the point that we make in the book is that most of those things fade away, that our memories are designed so that we don't remember most things that happen on a vacation. We don't remember most things that happen at university. People that have done research on this say that 40% of our memories come from the first 6 weeks of freshman year, because that's when all the new stuff was happening. We're decorating an apartment for the first time by ourselves. We're going to a party and not having to report in to someone when we get home, other than our roommates, perhaps. And so things fade in experience, and if we want to understand what's left over, the moments that are left over, the snapshots, the mental snapshots, then we need some different tools, potentially, than the ones that we've been working for journey mapping. The second problem is that we don't have very many tools for talking about positive experience as opposed to negative experience. If you think about the tools that we have in journey mapping, we diagram out the process, and then we typically start by asking, where is the customer encountering problems in this journey towards the product or service? And we pull out a suite of tools that are very effective at solving problems. We've got TQM tools, we've got Six Sigma tools. But notice that these tools are designed to get more and more subtle about fixing problems. In fact, if you go to Six Sigma quality, that means you only have 3.5 defects in 1,000,000 instances. Now that's a sign that you're doing pretty well, and probably the low-hanging fruit has been picked long before that in terms of finding problems. But I think there's tremendous upside. And we'll talk about a specific study later that we mentioned in the book that says that there is tremendous upside. There's $9 in value for creating peak moments and moving people from neutral or mildly satisfied up to satisfied, compared to the $1 that's available for solving problems. So what Dan and I really tried to do in The Power of Moments is to come up with a framework, a set of tools, for talking about the positive moments that we want to create for our families, for our patients in hospitals, for our students in schools, for our customers in business organizations. And the first tool is the tool that we call elevation. And here we highlight that defining moments very often are moments of elevated experience. They're super ordinary. They become extraordinary because they're so intense compared to ordinary experience. So the fireworks show with the light and the sound, the beautiful views at the national parks, the birthday cupcake. I mean, there's no better compact symbol of elevation than sugar, fat, and flame all in one tiny package. So how do we play with the notion of elevation? Well, there are some domains where it's pretty easy, remarkably easy. So DoubleTree Hotel is famous for the warm chocolatey cookie that you get when you check in. And I think that's a perfect moment of elevation because it's so welcome, and even if you've done it a dozen times before, you still get excited about eating the cookie on the way up to your room in the elevator when you check in to DoubleTree. And they're able to do that reliably over and over again. But think about the snack bar at the typical hotel. It's filled with a bunch of stuff that you've seen dozens of times before. And what if instead of the normal snack bar, what if you walked into your room and instead of the priced menu items that you were going to choose from the regular snack bar, there was on the desk in a place that's clear that it's free, there was a beverage and a snack item from the city that you're visiting that's local to the culture. So in New Orleans, the snack would be different than Austin, Texas, different from Seattle, Washington. And I've gone to places where, like, I think it was Pittsburgh one time, where there's this kind of red taffy that they grew up eating in Pittsburgh. And it's actually kind of wonderful. It's cherry taffy that I've never had before. And what if you took the specialty items of the local culture and you had those available. I think that would be a moment of elevation. It's sensory, it's intense, it's different from one city to another, so you never get tired of the surprise of walking in, what's it going to be in this new city. So it's pretty easy when you're dealing with food or beverage items because they're kind of built-in positive emotional associations. But what happens if you're not in that situation? Well, if you remember Pavlov won the Nobel Prize in Medicine for making an observation. And that observation was that if you rang a bell before a dog got food, and he always rang the bell a few seconds before the dog got food, that eventually the dog would start to salivate when they just heard the bell. So you take a neutral item, like a bell, and you associate it with something that has reinforcement properties, and all of a sudden you get the physiological reactions to the symbol itself, the bell symbol. And what's interesting about that is it says that anything can become emotional if it's associated with things that are already emotional. I was in a workshop with Google engineers in the Maps group. So these are the folks that make the product that's viewed by a billion people a month who are looking for directions on how to get somewhere from one place to another. And they were happy with their product. You have a billion customers, you've got to be happy with it. But they were worried that there was increasing competition in the mapping industry. And they said, we've got a good functional product, and we're really good at thinking about how do you make the information here 4% more accurate in terms of the addresses, or how do you make it load 3% more faster in this other situation. But what we're not good, they said, is establishing an emotional connection with someone. And we want people to not just use and respect our product, we want them to love it, because we want, when competitors come in, we want to have this storehouse of goodwill that's been produced over time. Well, how do you get people to love a mapping product? Well, we started off with the Pavlov principle. We said, well, you may not be emotional in and of yourself, but you're associated with lots of things that are emotional. And so one group came up with the idea of putting the automatic coffee button down at the bottom of the screen. So you could place this button on your Google Maps interface if you're a real coffee fan. And if you touch that button, the mapping device immediately directs you to the closest coffee that meets your coffee standards. So you can decide whether Dunkin' Donuts is okay or do you need Pete's special roast. And the app's going to take into account not only the transport time, but also the service time, because that's the information they store in the Maps application. And they started riffing on the idea, and they said, well, and we could form partnerships with some of the bigger coffee chains and have your coffee not only there, but already ordered and waiting for you hot on the counter at the time that you arrive. I think that's a service that would put Google Maps at the heart of coffee lovers' experience everywhere. And I personally want the sushi version. There may be people that want the pizza or the burger version for those munchy times late in the afternoon when you've skipped lunch so far. Another group took the exercise in a different direction. They said, you know, one of the most aversive things in our experiences is traffic, and people hate traffic jams. And so what if we had an app that popped up when we knew you were going to be stuck in a traffic jam, and it had a little roulette wheel that was colorful, and you could spin it, and all of a sudden you'd be matched with a relaxing experience of a kind that you want. So it could be a playlist of music from your high school and college years that would give you nostalgic memories, and it's timed exactly for the length of the delay in the traffic. Or it could be a TED Talk that would keep your interest. Or it could be that we know that a friend of yours is stuck in the same traffic jam, and we automatically dial the friend and put you in touch to talk to them while you're sitting in traffic. Now, for a group of engineers, that's a pretty good application of making things emotional that wouldn't have been emotional otherwise. Now, here's a warning for elevation. Your tendency is going to be to take things that are fives and sixes and try to make them sevens or seven and a halves. But seven and a half is not an elevated moment. A nine or a ten is an elevated moment. And so how do we focus enough to take something that is an okay experience and make it truly remarkable? I think one of my favorite examples of kind of arbitrariness in this work is I was reading reviews for restaurants in San Francisco area, breakfast restaurants, and within a few blocks of each other were two restaurants that were getting rave reviews for their pancakes. One was getting rave reviews for its silver dollar-sized pancakes. They said, you get this cute little stack of silver dollar-sized pancakes. There must be 50 of them in the stack. The other restaurant down the street was getting rave reviews for their gargantuan, oversized pancakes. They fill up more than the plate. I mean, they're as big as a football helmet. And that's pretty remarkable, because I'm pretty sure that the pancake batter that's going into the silver dollar pancakes or the football-sized helmet pancakes is exactly the same pancake batter that's served everywhere else on the standard-sized pancakes. But what those restaurants had done is they got people's attention by moving towards an extreme. And very often the things that are moments of elevation are going to move towards extreme. We don't want a 7.5 out of 10. We want to move the 7.5 up to a 10 out of 10, a 9 out of 10. And so it doesn't matter whether you go extra small on your pancakes or extra large on your pancakes. The point is, nobody's going to talk about your pancakes if they're standard size. And having a sensory experience that's elevated is about doing something remarkable. I want to cover one more part of the framework to illustrate a similar kind of principle. Let's move to connection. And I think the single idea that Dan and I are finding most useful in connection as we talk to people is Harry Reese's framework for summarizing responsiveness. So we feel connected to our parents, we feel connected to our spouse, we feel connected to our friends when those people are responsive to us. In Harry Reese's, there are three components of that. One is that they understand us, number two, that they validate us, and number three, that they care for us. And so the mom with the baby who's crying understands the baby, says, "Oh, honey, I'm sorry that you're wet, you got a wet diaper," validates. It's really hard to be happy when you've got a wet diaper, and then cares for the child by changing the diaper. But notice most service interactions are not quite that responsive. You walk into a hotel and the person, cheerful person behind the desk says, "How was your travel today?" And it almost doesn't matter what you say at that point. You could say, "Pretty awful day. The flight was delayed and we got stuck on the tarmac for a long time." The person's going to still go into the normal routine. And the normal routine happens to involve 3 minutes of email, as far as I can tell. They sit and type at the computer without interacting with you for a few minutes. But notice what would happen if the person was really responsive. So they might say, "Wow, that sounds like a rough day. You know, here, let me get you a cup of coffee over here, or a glass of wine, whichever one you want. We'll sit you down over there, and I'll come bring you your key when it's ready." That would be a responsive interaction. Or even just telling me what you're doing when you're typing away at the terminal. I fell in love with the person who checked me in the other day because they narrated the thing that they're probably doing all the time, but this person voiced it for me, said, "Well, you know, it sounds like you had a rough day. Let me find you a quiet room. I'm looking through our inventory. We're pretty booked up tonight. But here's one. Oh, no, it's too close to the elevators. I don't want to get you stuck by the elevators. Let me look at this other one. Oh, here's a nice room, partially down the hall. It'll be quiet for you. Have a good night's sleep, and then come and get a breakfast with us in the morning. We have morning coffee." That's a much more responsive interaction. And that's how we treat our friends. I mean, that's how it's not that we have to have special customer service skills. Everything that I just listed is exactly what you would have done if you had a friend staying with you and they walked in and had a tough travel day. You'd sit them over on the couch and cook dinner for them while they had a glass of wine or a cup of coffee. But there is an exception to responsiveness, and that's teenagers. Teenagers are actively trying not to be responsive because this is the time in their life when they're trying to separate their own identity from the identity of their family that they grew up with. And so teenagers actively undo every part of the responsiveness recipe. Do they understand? What's a teenager's favorite phrase? "Whatever." You know, that phrase is saying, "I don't understand." It's saying, "I don't validate what you're saying." And it's definitely was accompanied by the eye roll saying, "I don't care." And so teenagers are perfectly calibrated to respond in exactly the opposite way to make everybody happy when they move out of the house. But here's an interesting observation. Most of our technology that we use most every day is about as responsive as an eye-rolling teenager. I've been a customer of Expedia for probably 16 years now. And every time I book a flight, I have to go in and take the list that they've ordered of flights going from, say, I'm going to Denver from San Francisco. They've given me 22 flights ordered by their notion of value or attractiveness. But what I'm not interested in necessarily is the cheapest flight. What I am interested in is which flight's going to allow me to go to the meetings that I have scheduled already that day in San Francisco before I get on the plane to Denver. And so every time I have to check a box that says I only want to see nonstop flights. And every time I have to resort the flights from their measure of value to departure time. And every flight for 15 years, I've been doing that same exercise. And you might wonder why I'm still a customer. Well, I've looked at other people's websites, and they're no better than Expedia. So since my information is already in Expedia, I stick with them. Now notice how simple it would be for Expedia, instead of doing its eye-rolling, I don't care whatever you're doing because I'm going to do what I want to do anyway. What if they just said, you know, we've shown you just the nonstop flights, because last time you indicated that you cared about nonstops, and by the way, we've sorted them the way that you always sort your flights, which is by departure time. But let us know if you want to sort them any other way. That would be a great deal more responsiveness than we're typically used to from technology products. Yelp is the same way. I use Yelp all the time, but I always have to resort the items, the restaurants that they give me, by rating, because I'm willing to drive another 5 minutes for a great burrito. Now, we know that they have the capability of tracking this kind of information, leaving cookies about it, because we get tailored, personalized ads all the time. I mean, I accidentally clicked a Hello Kitty link about 18 months ago, and I'm still getting advertisements for Hello Kitty luggage, Hello Kitty golf clubs, right? So some advertiser has carefully calibrated and tailored what they think is the optimal selection of a merchandise for me, and I can't even get the website to sort things the way that I always sort things. So we talked about moving from a 7 to a 10 for elevation, being upping the sensory experience. I think what moving from a 7 to a 10 looks like in terms of connection is being slavishly attentive, like a great butler, like a great household servant in the old days, to the demands of the customer when we look and see what they're trying to do. Wells Fargo's ATM machines actually do this very well. So on every screen, they take and highlight the option that you've chosen most frequently in a green color. And just let you know that, you know, we're looking at you, we're understanding you, and we were going to validate your choice by giving you a special green color in case you want to do that thing again that you always do. In fact, they've gotten so good at learning my preferences that my typical interaction is I type in my password and I hit the green button on the very front screen that's right underneath the password, and I get cash in the amount that I always withdraw from the bank, because the ATM machine has learned that that's the most common thing that I do at the ATM. Well, as we end the podcast, I want to concede that moving from a 7 to a 10 is not always easy, even inside a small organization, because people are going to look at that and say, aren't we wasting some money on that? People look at the Magic Castle Hotel, I'm sure, the Popsicle Hotline, that brilliant innovation, and they say, well, do we really need the person from the front office to come out in the white gloves? I mean, what if we just had a cooler with the popsicles in the cooler, and people could self-serve? And by the way, keeping the ice in the cooler is kind of a hassle. So could we use kind of Tootsie Pops and just have those available for people who want something to munch on during the LA hot afternoon? And maybe even the Tootsie Pops aren't. Do people really like that caramel center? Maybe we just get some lollipops and leave them out by the pool. Now notice what they've done is they've taken an idea that had a lot of emotion and a lot of surprise and systematically whittled it away, becoming more and more efficient until it's an idea that has no power. It's utterly forgettable. And that's the force of normalcy as we try to tackle things that are not supposed to be normal. Our tendency is always going to be to smooth things out and make them more reliable, make them more like normal action. But in order to make an impact on people, in order to make a moment a defining moment, we have to go in the other direction. Remember the John Deere first day orientation where the dear friend would show up in the morning with your favorite beverage? Dan actually worked with a group that was working on a first day orientation, and they had adopted that as part of their at one point. But then somebody came in later that hadn't been a part of the initial discussion. They're saying, you know, it's really kind of inefficient to have a bunch of people separately meeting the new people with their favorite beverage. Why don't we just set up a coffee service in a room and have people report to that room? And notice that that's a perfect example of taking a great moment of connection, being met by the person I've been corresponding with my favorite chai latte, you know, and I feel like I've been understood by somebody at the firm already in the first moments of joining there, to go into a generic room with a generic coffee service like we've seen 1,000 times before loses the emotional point. But from the standpoint of the person making the comment, they were just being reasonable, they were being rational, they were doing things with standard operating procedures. But our goal, if we want to create moments, is to avoid the standardization, the routinization. Now, where's the money going to come from for all this? Well, remember that study that said that we're spending 4 times, we're spending 80% of our time trying to fix problems, and only 20% of our time trying to create peaks. I suggest there are some resources lying around that are chasing that dollar of revenue that was available for fixing problems. Because remember, for every dollar of revenue that was available for fixing problems and making dissatisfied people into neutral people, if we took the neutral people and the mildly satisfied people and moved them up to very satisfied, there was $9 of revenue available for that. So both in terms of the revenue upside and in terms of the cost of effort, we're spending 80% of our time chasing a dollar in revenue. And why don't we reallocate some of that time, instead of focused on fixing the potholes in the road, reallocate that to creating something great. I talked to a science museum recently that had started to get this right, and they said, we want to thank you for writing this book because it enabled us to simplify a lot of discussions that we've been having about our physical plan. So for example, we've got a parking lot, they said, that it's kind of hard to get back and forth from the parking lot to the building, and it's kind of a pothole in the exercise. Nobody ever gets really lost, but it takes them a little longer to find their way out than they should have. But we've been thinking about improving the signage in there, and what we haven't been thinking about is the fact that that's at best fixing a pothole. It's not going to make anybody thrilled about science. So, you know, what if that group turned their attention from fixing the signage to thinking about what would it be like to paint a big T-Rex body on this floor of this garage so that people could see that a T-Rex stretched out is the equivalent of that dozen cars over there? What if they put up signs and said, you know, all the cars in these two rows added up in weight wouldn't equal to half of a blue whale weight? I think people would be so busy thinking about science in the garage that they wouldn't worry about the fact that the signage is a little hard to read. Creating defining moments is not hard, it's not impossible, but it is an unnatural act. And so you need all your superpowers to resist that soul-sucking force of reasonableness, making things similar, making things standard operating procedure, making things look like everything else that's been gone before. Your goal is to preserve the wow moments, the 10 out of 10 moments, and to work towards them. Good luck with your important work.